The politics of disaster planning as another storm season begins.
And smoking marijuana for medical reasons is okayed, but don't light up just yet.
This is the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Alberto may have formed before the official start of hurricane season, but the governor was quick to declare a state of emergency for the entire state. Meanwhile, Florida's new hurricane planning chief is just 30 years old and new to emergency management. Plus, a judge rules you can smoke medical marijuana in Florida, but the state's fighting that. And how are doctors prescribing the drug?
You can join the conversation at 305-995-1800 on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Your phone calls coming up after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. It's the Statewide Edition this hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, it's Friday, June 1st. You know what that means here
Indeed.
In Florida. Hurricane season is officially underway today. Now, the 2018 storm season actually began more than a week before the official start today, when Alberto formed just off the Yucatan Peninsula about a week ago. 3 days later, Alberto made landfall in the panhandle, bringing along those tropical storm force winds, up to 3 feet of storm surge and periods of heavy rain.
And, you know, it was 2 days before landfall that Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency for the entire state, warning the storm, quote, poses a severe risk to the entire state of Florida. This according to his executive order. But, you know, that severe threat never materialized for most Floridians. So did the governor cry wolf on Alberto? Storms are certainly tests of leadership, and they're difficult to forecast, but are politics playing a role here? And the media, you know, Melissa, we're often derided for overhyping weather risks in the lead-up mm-hmm. to the potential storm, but is there a risk of not ringing the alarm when severe weather threatens? We'll open up the phones right now, 305-995-1800 across the state.
Give us a call anywhere in Florida as we talk about the start of hurricane season. Now, speaking of Alberto, what there was of it, it was actually the first storm and the first test for Governor Scott's new emergency management director. Wesley Maul got that critically important job after serving in an interim capacity for about 2.5 months. Maul is just 30 years old. Is he prepared? After last year's destructive and deadly storm season, is he ready to lead us through hurricane season this year? Is the state ready for what's forecasted to be an average storm season, but you never know? How about all of you out there? Are you ready for hurricane season? Give us a call, 305-995-1800, as we welcome Elizabeth Coe of the Miami Herald and Brian Norcross. He's a meteorologist and a hurricane expert and specialist with WPLG Television in Miami and also the Weather Channel. Brian, let's begin with you. Before we get into the politics of this, right off the bat, let's be clear. Storm experts and meteorologists like you are saying we're looking at an average hurricane season, but as you've been writing about, forecasting can be reasonably certain, but we can't be 100% certain that we're not looking at another tough hurricane season. What are your thoughts about this as you look at the models?
Well, I'm always hearkening back to 1992 and Hurricane Andrew. It was a very slow hurricane season and extraordinarily slow. There was only really one storm that was any kind of significant storm and any kind of threat, and that was Hurricane Andrew. So we can't really look at the sort of intensity of the hurricane season, which really only refers to the number of named storms that are going to form in the Atlantic or the Gulf or the Caribbean. We have to think about whether we need to prepare or not, and the fact is we have to prepare every year because it only takes one.
That's right. Only takes one, Elizabeth Coe. And let's talk about the state's preparedness. Governor Scott got pretty high marks for how he led us through last year, and particularly with Hurricane Irma. This time around, he's appointed a 30-year-old to serve as the new emergency management director for the state. He also declared a state of emergency for all of Florida before Alberto. That might have been going a little too far. These are tests for state leaders, for governors. First off, let me ask you about how the governor handled Alberto. Did he overplay that? given that he's now taking on Bill Nelson for U.S. Senator, was he being responsible? Is it better to err on the side of caution with these storms?
Well, thanks for having me. I think that is a question that I can't necessarily answer, right? That's a question that people who live in the state of Florida are definitely going to have to answer for themselves. It is pretty clear that given what the governor had done on Saturday didn't play out in the way that you're describing, right? Declaring a state of emergency for all 67 counties when most of those counties didn't really see much more than a lot of rain and some flooding. But you are right. The governor has to be acutely aware of the fact that his decisions this hurricane season are going to be even more closely scrutinized than they would be in any other hurricane season, in part because he is auditioning for Floridians to represent them in the United States Senate.
Let's have our meteorologist scrutinize that decision a little bit here and wade from the weather science into politics somewhat. First of all, Alberto, a subtropical storm, a new phrase that a lot of Floridians are learning or have had
which
to learn.
Which we learn and forget.
That's right.
It comes around all the time.
Yeah, exactly,
We don't remember this.
But how about that? I mean, as a meteorologist, I imagine you were plugged in and saw that the governor declared a state of emergency for all 67 counties, the entire state of Florida, on Saturday morning, just before 10 a.m., when you saw the last or the most recent hurricane center bulletin on Alberto. Were you surprised by that declaration?
I wasn't surprised because it's unfortunate that's the way that Florida rolls these days.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so go back a few years to Tropical Storm Erica, which, if you recall, was down by, it hit Dominica very badly. Yep. It was down by
very
the Caribbean
similar path
Islands.
To Irma.
Yes, although it was more in the Caribbean Islands, a little farther south.
Right.
But it was coming in general toward Florida. And on the Weather Channel, there was a big lower third piece of text there that said state of emergency in Florida, which the governor had done the same thing, declared a state of emergency. And I went on the Weather Channel and said, there is no emergency in Florida. Let me just start there. There is no emergency in Florida. The problem is that in order to initiate various operational things and free up money to allow certain people and facilities and supplies.
Sure, there's some logistical reasons for a state of emergency,
right.
No doubt about it. It activates certain things within government to make things happen.
So it's a terrible name for that activation. What we really need is we need readiness level one, we need readiness level two, and then we can say we're moving the state to readiness level two, and it's like DEFCON. You know, we don't have to go to DEFCON 5 or 1, whatever the worst is, immediately, which is the only way the system works now. So there's a flaw in the law. They probably do, you know, kick it off to that too early. But I don't know that it's hard to judge that because there
you can only judge that in hindsight.
You can only judge that in hindsight.
Right.
And the fact is that many of the things they do initially under the state of emergency are very mundane. And they're very responsible things. So it's a case of poor communications, I think. If the governor were doing it right and if I were doing it, I would say, I'm declaring a state of emergency because the law requires me to do that. There is no emergency. Let's just prepare responsibly for the possibility.
Talk about mixed messages if that were the case, though,
right? But I'm saying that's what the law calls
for. Sure.
And, you know, given the death and destruction we've all lived through, on the other hand, you can understand maybe overhyping something that doesn't always turn out to be as bad as we thought. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Koh, let's talk about this new appointment by Governor Scott. Wesley Maul will be the state's new emergency management director. He served in an interim capacity for just a few months before getting this big push up. He's 30 years old. Is he prepared to lead the state through the upcoming storm season? There's been some criticism of this appointment. What are you hearing about this?
So people who are allies of the new emergency management director will tell you that he has an interesting background, right? He used to serve as the governor's travel aide when he was in his reelection campaign back in 2013, 2014, and after 2.5 years in that role, became chief of staff at the Division of Emergency Management and was in that role for 2 years before he became interim director when the most recent past director decided to return to the private sector. And people who think Westmall is qualified will tell you, you know, that is a unrivaled crash course into understanding how the governor works and runs a state and how agencies work together to manage disasters. But a lot of the criticism that people have raised is that many of Westmall's predecessors in the role, Craig Fugate, Brian Kuhn, have had positions in emergency management for decades even before taking this particular role. So that is essentially, you know, kind of how things stand. Westmall is young. He has worked closely with the governor, but he also had very little emergency management experience before becoming the director and before he became chief of staff, had none at all. So it is definitely going to be a test of how he manages the state's disasters in the top spot. But it's also kind of important to note that because the governor is term limited, it's not necessarily likely that Westmall will remain in the position for more than this hurricane season. So,
Elizabeth,
true enough.
What is the division, what is the state agency, the Emergency Management Division, say about the lack of Director Mall's direct experience when it comes to emergency planning on the scale of the state of Florida?
Well, the governor, when he appointed Westmall as interim director, said he believed very strongly, you know, in Wes's abilities and his ability to manage the state through a disaster season. Westmall himself did not agree to speak on the record when I was working on a story earlier last month, I guess now, because it's June.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're asking for what the director would say when faced with those criticisms, I don't know, because he wouldn't talk on the record to the media about
and
his past experience.
As your paper, the Miami Herald, has reported, essentially Governor Scott is rewarding a political operative. He's also elevated a number of other former campaign staffers as he goes out the door. And certainly rewarding loyalists is not the first time a politician has done that. But this is such an important role, as you said. Typically, people that lead emergency management in a hurricane-prone state like Florida have decades of experience. Right?
Yeah. I mean, that is something that I don't think can be contested, right? You look at the biographies of people who have preceded Wes in this role, and they're people who have been in emergency management for longer. It is interesting to note that the governor has elevated not just campaign aides, right, but people who have been in this specific role that Wes had when he was working with the governor, travel aides, to hold other important positions in the administration. And allies will tell you that's because they know how he works, and the governor is very hands-on when he runs his agencies. And other people will tell you, well, look at the experience that they had before they started working with the governor, not necessarily a whole ton.
This relates to another agency that's important during hurricane season, which is the state agency that oversees the insurance industry. This was something the governor did just a couple of years ago, appointing a director who had a relatively young director with just a few years of experience in that industry. We're speaking with Elizabeth Coe, the Miami Herald. Brian Norcross is along with us, meteorologist and hurricane expert and hurricane specialist at WPLG-TV in Miami and the Weather Channel, talking about hurricane season. June 1st in the Sunshine State, 305-995-1800. Are you prepared? Is the state prepared? What's the forecast look? One storm already in the books here in the 2018 season before it began. Brian in St. Augustine has given us a call. Brian, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, I was just calling to comment. As a person in the tourism industry in the city of St. Augustine, I own a historic inn, and the amount of, I just wanted to comment in on the amount of damage that I see done when these officials or media outlets really kind of hype a storm situation that may not or may have very little effect on our area. It really affects tourism. The cancellations come in. The towns go quiet, etc. And even after an event has happened, most recently with Matthew and Irma, there was so much on television, and the officials speaking about it made it seem as though, you know, the whole town had been destroyed, when in actuality, it wasn't, and we were back open for business within days.
Yeah. Brian, I hear the same kind of complaints when it comes to the Florida Keys, which were directly impacted, certainly, by Hurricane Irma. We were speaking with some of the emergency management folks and tourism folks just yesterday here in South Florida about their preparations for the 2018. But to Brian Norcross, how do you respond to Brian, the innkeeper in St. Augustine, that the oversaturation that we can be guilty of in the media when it comes to these storms has a real economic consequence for those areas that may be on the fringes of the effect?
Well, it absolutely does. Look at what's going on in Hawaii right now. Hawaii extends over 1,000 miles or something like that, and the volcano is at one end of it, and they have significant tourism effects 100 miles away and several hundred miles away. So here's the problem. The challenge is that I was at a Google meeting recently, and they talked about how it is that people can't read maps anymore because their phone tells them where to go. They don't even know north from south. They only know right from left. So, you know, a problem is that trying to describe accurately and easily to people the part of Florida that's affected by any storm is a challenge. So when the media says that Florida is affected and a significant part of Florida could be affected, there's no question that all of Florida gets lumped into that messaging. So that's reality. The other reality is that quite often we don't know exactly where the most dangerous or even significantly dangerous parts of the storm are, and we don't really want to have tourists in places that could be threatened. We want them out. And just that process is a costly process for people that own tourism-related industries. That's just the reality of living in the storm, in a hurricane zone, I think. So we have to have an ounce of reality about the uncertainty.
You know, you're a hurricane veteran, obviously, Brian Norcross. And Elizabeth Koh, as Brian Norcross is talking about the communication challenges here in 2018, and Brian, the caller in St. Augustine, talking about the economic impact of it, I continue to be reminded of the relative youthfulness of the gentleman who's now in charge of communicating emergency disaster preparedness and response in the state of Florida, and how, you know, as a member of the media, Elizabeth, Melissa, I think you may agree with this. We haven't seen Mr. Maul, Director Maul, in front of a microphone at a time of you know, significant disaster.
We did get a comment from the state, though, an email to the show right before we went on the air, Tom, saying the Florida Division of Emergency Management and all staff are absolutely committed to ensuring the safety of Florida's residents and visitors during this hurricane season. Well, of course, they would be committed to that. But Elizabeth, none of us have. We will presumably be seeing this young man on television, along with Brian Norcross and others, if there is a series of storms coming up, and on the radio.
I'm not sure about that, honestly. I mean, because this governor has not deferred to their emergency management director as previous governors have.
And I'm going to second Brian here.
Recall that Brian Kuhn stood behind Governor Scott at news conference after news conference after news conference, where we really didn't need to hear from the governor. We really needed to hear more technical information about what the emergency management department was doing, in my opinion. Not that I thought the governor did a bad job, but I just thought it was incomplete. It was sort of repetitive from a kind of newcomer on the edge of the emergency process. He's a very talented
person. Elizabeth Koh, any reason to believe that is going to remain the same with the new director or change?
I think to harken back to a point that you guys made a little bit earlier in the show, the governor has a lot riding on this hurricane season. The kind of political wisdom of the state goes, right? Politicians' records can be made or broken on how they handle responses to emergencies, particularly storms like these. I don't think there is any indication that will necessarily change. It is worth noting that Wes Maul did address members of the Division of Emergency Management during the state briefing that they held over the weekend in response to Subtropical Storm Alberto, but that was because the governor was traveling.
Let's just hope for a quiet season. Elizabeth Koh with the Miami Herald, Brian Norcross with WPLG. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. For 3 years, Jordan Mayberry and her husband worked to pay for renovating their home in Everglades City. There was a new kitchen, a new pool, new garage, all wiped away by Hurricane Irma's 10-foot storm surge.
We are in our camper, and this is post-Irma. Our camper is placed in our backyard. I'm sorry. Sometimes it's just hard to talk about.
Mayberry says they've received $1,500 from the Federal Emergency Management Agency since Irma. They're still waiting, Melissa, for their homeowner's insurance.
Yeah, Irma exposed vulnerabilities and difficulties for so many residents around the state in preparing for and responding to a huge storm like that. We saw the mass evacuations, jamming up roads, the storm's size, the sheer size of it, complicated relief efforts. Greg Lubrecki with the Gulf Coast Community Foundation in Sarasota County says it's local groups that bear the brunt of recovery.
I think more and more in general, we're getting used to the fact that nonprofits and community organizations are relied upon to do a lot during times of sunshine as well as disasters.
Right now, we're continuing our look at the start of hurricane season. It begins today with taking a quick look back at how many people around Florida are still struggling after last season. Back with us, Elizabeth Coe of the Miami Herald and Rachel Iacovone, producer and reporter with WGCU in Fort Myers. She joins us via Skype. And if you're still struggling after Irma last year, we want to hear from you right now. Call us at 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup. Rachel, it's amazing to think about how many people out there listening all across the state are still in really bad shape. As we head into another season, they still haven't recovered from last hurricane season.
Yes, absolutely. As you just heard with the Mayberries, they're living in a camper and they're not alone. Most of Everglades City is in the same situation.
What are you seeing in Everglades City? Paint a picture for us, for people that have never seen what it's like there.
Well, it's a very small town. As Jordan kind of talks about, it's very tight-knit. There are only 400 households there. And so it's very much reliant on the stone crab season, you know, fishing throughout the year. And you can kind of see one side of town from the other. So it's impacting all of them. And everyone right now is either in these types of trailers or they're not in their destroyed homes. They've gone somewhere else. So when you're driving through it now, it used to be this quaint and cute town. And now it's kind of depressing, honestly. It's very gray. A lot of the topsoil was taken by Irma, so it's just been run off and everything looks damp. And of course, we've gotten a lot of rain recently, but ever since the storm, yeah.
Yeah, hasn't been the same since. Elizabeth Coe, Everglades City, I think, is a good example of what we're seeing in pockets around the state. People still struggling, still waiting for disaster relief funds, kind of caught up in the red tape of all of that. Just hearing a lot of that around Florida many months later.
Elizabeth, judge kind of the state's response to Irma, and I guess more importantly, is it talking about doing anything differently this year?
Yep. Have we lost Elizabeth?
I think we may have lost Elizabeth.
Okay. As we try to get her back, give us a call here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. Hurricane season begins today. Are you ready? Are you still having issues from last year? Rachel, what are people telling you, like Mr. Mayberry, they get a little money maybe from FEMA. They're still waiting for insurance to kick in. There's this huge gap of time where people are struggling and they often are out of their home. They're in a camper. They've just moved away and given up completely. Often people just kind of they give up completely, don't they, as to ever getting any of the funds that they were promised?
Well, I was surprised when I was there that the Mayberries were saying most of the town decided to stay. And to me, I was looking at the devastation and saying, how? Why? But they said in large part it was the community. You know, everyone came together and they're all in the same situation. So moving elsewhere to a new town and a new home with the risk of a hurricane if you're in Florida, then it just didn't make sense for them. Their kids are so invested in their school there. The last graduating class was 7 kids. So it's just such a tight-knit community that they had roots there and they wanted to continue to grow.
Let me bring Brian Norcross back into our conversation, meteorologist and hurricane specialist at WPLG Television in Miami and with the Weather Channel. Brian, Hurricane Irma is certainly kind of a benchmark, most recent benchmark for us. Hurricane Andrew is the most significant one here in South Florida. But Irma, while a Category 4 on the books for a large part of South Florida and a large part of Florida, was barely a tropical storm.
Yeah, let me make a couple points here that I think are important. Exactly what you said, Tom, that the only Category 4 winds in Hurricane Irma were in a relatively small part of the Florida Keys, in Big Pine Key and Kudzu Key. That's it. In southwest Florida, up around Everglades City, the main impact there was storm surge. And the fact that there was so much damage in Everglades City is really symptomatic of the extreme storm surge threat in the entire west coast of the state of Florida. And it's terrible for the folks in Everglades City, but we were tremendously lucky that that didn't happen in the extremely highly populated areas of Collier County, yeah, Lee County, and on up the coast. And, you know, we think of Irma, I think, justifiably, it's our most recent storm in our mind. It was such a big storm. It was slow moving. It seemed to blow all day and night. But the effects on Florida really were minimal by historical hurricane standards, given the amount of infrastructure. Yes, it was a $50 billion storm, more or less, in Florida. But, it acted more like a Category 1-ish, maybe 2-ish storm in Florida than it did a Category 4 storm. And if you think about the amount of aggravation that people are going through right now in recovery, right? You know, you can, if it had maintained its Category 4 strength and really hit the peninsula as a Category 4 storm, you'd be multiplying by 100 or 1,000 that aggravation. It's an entirely different scale.
The what ifs of past hurricanes. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800. Are you prepared for this 2018 season? Any remnant effects of Hurricane Irma? Brian in Coral Gables in South Florida is joining us. Brian, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I am a full-time instructor at a major university, and I'm paid on a 9-month salary, which means that for the months of June, July, and August, I have no meaningful income unless I do additional work. And I know that my situation is not unique. Many, many faculty teaching at higher ed institutions as well as primary and secondary schools are also paid on 9-month schedule. A significant number of us skilled labor force, therefore, has very little money going into the summer unless they've budgeted extremely carefully. And I have, as for example, several thousand dollars of credit card debt that I had to use my credit card in order to survive Hurricane Irma and get through the experience. I just don't think that I'm ready for the next year. I maybe afford 2 weeks of groceries, but if another major storm comes this way, it will be significant economic hardship for which there's very little relief available.
And I know so many people around the state feel the same way. Thanks for calling. And, you know, I think we all have our fingers crossed for a quiet storm season. Let's go to Jim in Naples. Jim, you've got a comment about insurance.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I own a small insurance agency in Naples, and I have a couple of issues. And number one, I thought that the insurance companies were just absolutely terrible in terms of handling claims. I could go into details about that, but I don't think that would be helpful. But one thing I thought was very, very helpful in my experience of trying to guide my clients through this, through the delays, etc., was to direct them to file a complaint with the insurance commissioner's office in the state of Florida. And at that point, it's a very simple, no cost situation for the consumer. And at that point, the insurance company has 20 days to make an official response, and that can tend to speed up payment and clarification quite a bit. And secondarily, I'd like to comment on the fact that in Naples, despite the warnings of big storm surges, the water went out from the shoreline hundreds of yards.
Yes.
We saw Tampa Bay drain up north. Yeah, right.
Right, Tampa Bay drained out altogether.
And I think this is a very, very new circumstance, as far as I've heard, in terms of hurricanes and their effects, and maybe indicative of climate change, differences in hurricane seasons that we're going to expect, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought this was meteorologically, this was a very, very different situation with this.
Thank you for that, Jim. Yeah, and Brian Norcross, I'd love to get your thoughts on that. But first, Rachel, what about his comments about the insurance piece and the people you've interviewed in Southwest Florida and their struggles with that part of still recovering?
Yeah, the Mayberries right now are actually still in the camper in their backyard because they're waiting for their insurance to settle and allow them to knock down their home, which is filled with mold and whatnot. Their house was actually raised before the storm, but not raised enough. So the 10-foot storm surge that was mentioned earlier, it hit Everglades City the hardest instead of it was supposed to hit South Naples, which is much more populated. But this area, even being raised homes, was not prepared for 10 to 15 feet of water. So it filled most homes up to the electrical outlets. And now many people there are waiting for the okay just to knock down their existing homes.
And Brian Norcross, the National Hurricane Center has brought out new ways this season to sort of show when and where strong winds will arrive within that famous cone that you guys show on television, the cone of concern. You know, people play drinking games based on when a forecaster says there's a cone of concern. You know, Irma was the biggest evacuation in storm history in this country. And do you think the tools emergency managers are working on, the lessons they learned from Irma, will help the state this time around? Do you think we're a little better prepared this year, or something is just impossible to prepare for? As Jim pointed out from Naples, that storm did weird things with the water that we really hadn't seen before. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So a couple of clarifications. One is that, indeed, in terms of the number of people ordered to evacuate, it was a record. It was, I don't know that it was a record in terms of the number of people that did, because honestly, the traffic that we saw evacuating for Irma was not that bad, considering the number of people in Florida all trying to get on one or two roads. That's not what real evacuation traffic looks like if you go back and look at Hurricane Rita that was threatening Houston.
Yeah, well, I'm just quoting NPR. It called it the largest hurricane evac in U.S. history.
Evacuation orders.
Six million Floridians lived in evacuation zones for Hurricane Irma.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine the evacuation rate was somewhere in the 30 or 40% range. It's generally something like that. So on the issue of the water going out, was highly anticipated. It happens all over the world when a storm interacts with a very surge-prone coastline in the right way. So the fact that the water went out in Southwest Florida and it went out of Tampa Bay when the winds were blowing from the land to the water on the front side of the storm is a sign of how tremendously vulnerable that coastline is to storm surge. The reason we didn't get the 10 feet of storm surge over Naples, Fort Myers Beach, and on up the coast, including in Tampa Bay, was because the back half of Irma essentially dried out. So this was not a donut when it hit. It was more like a croissant. It was a half of a storm. Right, there was a front half of a storm that had decent winds once they got up to Fort Myers Category 1, maybe Category 2 in Naples, but still enough to push that water out in Category 1-ish in Tampa. That shows how vulnerable that water is to moving, right? Yeah. But when the backside, if the backside had been intact, it would have slammed that water back at the coast, creating tremendous storm surge, but it didn't. The backside had dried out by the time it hit the Keys. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Keys also only got half a storm. They got storm surge from the ocean and not much from Florida Bay.
Using pastries to describe our meteorological reality here in South Florida. Brian Norcross with us here, meteorologist, hurricane specialist at WPLG-TV and the Weather Channel. Celebrating next week, 50 years in broadcasting, Brian. Congratulations on that, and thanks for spending
a week from today.
Hurricane season here,
scary
the beginning of it
is.
With us here on the Florida Roundup. And
you,
Rachel Iacovone, producer and reporter with WGCU, joining us via Skype from Fort Myers. Rachel, thank you for sharing your reporting with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Well, the state's ban on smoking medical marijuana seems to have gone up in smoke. Last week, a judge in Leon County ruled that Florida's ban on smokable medical marijuana is unconstitutional. Now, medical marijuana, of course, has been legal in the state since the voters approved it in 2016. But you haven't been allowed to smoke the drug, only to take it in other forms like vaping or with a pill, oil, or spray. But don't light up just yet, Tom. The judge's ruling has been delayed because the Florida Department of Health immediately appealed. That will impose a stay until an appellate court can issue a final order on all of this.
Yeah, in fact, I think there's a hearing next week on that stay. So as all of this legal battle plays out, patients in Florida are still getting medical marijuana and doctors are being trained in how to prescribe it. Now, Florida has nearly 1,300 physicians qualified and registered to determine if a patient should and could use medical marijuana. Physicians do an initial exam, take into account medical records. They may diagnose a qualifying condition like epilepsy or glaucoma, for instance. So here's how it works. A qualified physician places potential patients on the state's medical marijuana use registry. They can then apply for the state identification card to then receive the drug. Potential patients or their caregivers also have to submit an application to the state's Office of Medical Marijuana Use.
So we kind of wondered, how's all this been working? We're going to talk right now to one doctor who's involved with cannabis. He's Dr. Harold Lasky of the Medical Marijuana Clinic in Jacksonville. He's with us now from WJCT in Jacksonville. And also joining the show, Dara Kam. She's a reporter with News Service of Florida. She joins via Skype from Tallahassee. And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the rollout of medical marijuana around the state? Are you a patient? Have you had trouble accessing the drug? What do you think about a judge saying that you should be allowed to smoke cannabis to cure what ails you? Give us a call at 305-995-1800. Dr. Harold Lasky of the Medical Marijuana Clinic, thanks for being with us. Can you clarify something? First off, doctors can't technically prescribe medical marijuana in Florida. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely correct. What we're really able to do is recommend it. The doctor will see the patient, and I hate calling it patient now because we're not writing a prescription, but we will evaluate, and depending on what diagnosis is present that qualifies for the recommendation, we will do basically what we would do with a general patient to make sure that they do qualify, and then we can enter their information in the Florida Drug Database, which is a state-run database. At that point, the patient would get all their information in, and once everything is together, then the patient can go to what they now call treatment centers. And I really don't like that term. I don't call a pharmacy a treatment center. Huh. And since there are no prescribers there, to me, we're a treatment center, so but that's personal opinion.
That's your opinion. We're going to get more of your opinion here on the Florida Roundup as we talk medical marijuana. Keep listening here on Florida Public Radio. Back in a moment.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Lots of calls about medical marijuana as we speak with Dr. Harold Lasky of Medical Marijuana Clinic. So how brisk, I guess, has business been since the voters legalized cannabis?
Well, it's been quite good, especially the phone calls. Now, our clinic is, I'll say, a little more conservative than some others because there are literally less than a dozen actual diagnoses that are allowed to be recommended for medical marijuana use. And I'm not going to give the whole list because you can
get that
anywhere. But interestingly, what most people around the country have wanted to use it for was for chronic pain. And you'll see a lot of studies which have shown in several states where medical marijuana has been used that the amount of, let's say, the opioids which have you've been used for chronic pain treatment have gone down, I think they said in Texas, by about 25%.
Dr. Lasky, we have a call about just that issue that I want to get to in a moment, but I want to bring in Dara Kam with us, a reporter at News Service of Florida, with us via Skype. Dara, take us back a week ago, this court ruling over the ability to essentially ingest medical marijuana in leaf form. That's a very fancy way of saying you can smoke marijuana if you are in the registry, although that ruling's on hold. How did it get to this point?
Well, John Morgan, who largely bankrolled Amendment 2 that legalized medical marijuana, he sued the state after legislators passed a law that banned smokable marijuana on behalf of himself, his organization, and two plaintiffs, including Kathy Jordan, who has ALS and uses smokable. She smokes it. She grows it herself. Mm-hmm. And she smokes it, and she's credited smokable marijuana with saving her life. And she's smoked it for almost 30 years now. So Judge Karen Beavers in Leon County ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and said that that patients should be able to smoke it, that the constitutional amendment, the language of it, permits smoking, and that the state erred when they passed a law that banned it.
This was the constitutional amendment that I think 70% of voters who voted approved of it, which did not specify the delivery method for the medical marijuana.
Correct.
But now the state is appealing this, and I think there's a hearing next week, correct?
Monday morning, there's a hearing. They've appealed it, which kicked in an automatic stay. What will happen next week is Judge Beavers is likely to vote to rule in favor of the plaintiffs. They're asking her to lift the stay, the hold, and she's likely to rule in their favor. The state will appeal that to the First District Court of Appeals, which will again put her decision on hold. And so let's just say that, you know, patients who want to smoke this won't be running out next week and being able to smoke it.
Let's go now to Henry in Atlantic Beach. Henry, thanks for calling the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to reiterate how important medical marijuana has been for my family. My wife has had both of her hips transplanted, the first one 15 years ago, and she's been on opiates for that long. And since, you know, being able to vape, she has dropped the amount of opiates by half. And, you know, I used to listen to her, you know, cry in her sleep and how much pain she was in. And when she started doing the vaping, she told me, she goes, "Henry, I feel like I have been lifted out of my body, and it's the first time I've been without pain." And it's so, I can't tell you how happy I am to see her finally out of pain. So
I'm happy to hear that, Henry. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, Dr. Lesky, I know you hear a lot of that type of feedback from your patients.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, this is what we might call anecdotal discussions of it. One of the big problems that we've found is there's just such a lack of real research. One reason, because still marijuana use is federally illegal, which makes research, especially in the United States, much more difficult. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the research today, and they came out with an article within 3 days that said no evidence that it helps chronic pain patients for the pain. And yet we see patient after patient who have said that it works.
Yeah. We have a call to this effect, Dr. Lesky.
It's a problem.
We've got a call from Jessica in Jacksonville talking about the reclassification of cannabis. Go ahead, Jessica.
Yes, hi. I'm a nurse in Jacksonville, and I've worked with people who have epilepsy for the last 8 or so years, and I have the same problem. My providers are very hesitant to recommend marijuana for their patients because they're uncertain what the side effects might be or what the effects might be on their epilepsy, if any at all. We have lots of patients who have medically intractable epilepsy, and we're hearing, you know, lots of potential good things about CBD oil or marijuana use, but the research is really just not far along enough for my providers to feel comfortable writing the prescription. And until the federal government reclassifies marijuana, it's going to be so hard to get that good research.
Yeah. Or as we learned earlier from Dr. Lasky, writing the recommendation, not the prescription, if I'm correct on that, doctor. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Derek Hamm.
You can certify them,
Just quickly, Derek Hamm, this medical treatment argument, did that come into the legal question about whether or not Floridians who have been recommended marijuana should be able to smoke it or not?
I mean, it's a treatment that is ordered by the recommended route of administration, recommended by the physician. That is one of the arguments, but they mostly relied on the language of the amendment itself, Tom, because what they were saying is the amendment allows local governments and the state to ban smoking in public places, which implies, if not directly says, then that means that it's permitted to be smoked in private places. And the judge agreed with that. So a lot of it was, you know, is it allowed? You know, what is the language of the amendment? And then what is the intent of the amendment? And they relied also on an intent document that they provided to the public prior to the vote that said...
And let's go quickly get in one more call. It's Daniel in North Miami. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a nurse. I work in hemodialysis. And I'm just wondering, how does the rollout of medical marijuana in the state of Florida compare with other states like Colorado, California, et cetera?
Let's get Dr. Lasky quickly before we wrap up this show. Your thoughts about that?
It's different in every state. As a matter of fact, a lot of the states do allow the use of it for diagnoses such as the chronic pain. I just want to say that most of my patients that I have that are recommended for epilepsy and PTSD have been, I'll say, at least 90% successful. I've seen patients who have decreased their epileptic medications, who have had significantly less seizures and less traumatizing seizures. And in PTSD, people who can now walk in places where they couldn't before.
Mm. Wow. So and what do you think about the smoking, the whole flap over whether it can be smoked? And is it more efficacious for some patients that way or not?
It's a funny question, only in because all of these things can be either political, they could be philosophical, psychological, or medical. Medically, vaping is probably, or it appears to be, a better way of doing it than smoking. But philosophically, anecdotally, we have seen that some patients feel that they've tried both ways and they do better with the smoking. We have not done enough research to prove it one way or the other.
Dr. Lasky, could you see yourself recommending to a patient to smoke a medicine?
Well, what you're talking about is the side effects and long-term effects,
right,
such as tobacco. You know, I think one of the things that we're going to do in the state here, the country, was try to get rid of the nicotine so people would not have the addictive quality of regular cigarettes. And that was not because the nicotine is the cancer producer, but it stops people from wanting to smoke. I think smoking here would be more deleterious than vaping.
You prefer vaping.
Number one, because you're not getting that same temperature.
Right.
You prefer your patients vape.
I think that the vaping medically has much better benefits, unless it's psychologically, someone just feels it's better, therefore it is. Placebos can have a good effect too.
I know you're running out of time, but I will say that on the other side, the proponents and the lawyers who argued this case said it doesn't matter what the doctor thinks is better for you. If it's allowed in the Constitution, then it has to be permitted. The state can't ban it. For this patient, Kathy Jordan, who's had Lou Gehrig's disease for 30 years, she says that smoking is the most efficacious for her because it makes her cough. So she coughs up phlegm, which gathers in her lungs overnight in the morning. That keeps her from drowning in her own phlegm, which she could die from. And it also gives her dry mouth, which prevents excessive drooling, which is another side effect. And vaping makes her gag and doesn't have those same positive side effects that smoking does.
Wow, positive side effects of smoking. I never would think that phrase would be uttered. But I guess that's where we're at here with the medical marijuana debate in the state of Florida. So the hearing on the stay is scheduled on Monday of the coming week as the court case continues to wind its way through the court system in regards to allowing Floridians to smoke medical marijuana.
Thanks so much, Dr. Harold Lasky of Medical Marijuana Clinic, Derek Hamm of News Service of Florida, for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know,
and that's our show for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Murchard is our producer.
Jason Zabka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Merritt. Engineering help today from Charles Michaels. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next week.